Have you ever been in a situation where you walk in a room and there's that weight of awkwardness because there's this elephant in the room and there's some issue that maybe one person's super mad and did something to someone else and no one's talking about it, and there's just that, often these times in family gatherings, this is kind of common. But have you ever had one of those situations, arm raised? Yep. It's awkward, right? And sometimes it's like the situation's not that bad. Like, it's worse, that feeling of heaviness and pressure of the not talking to each other, sometimes worse than what actually happened. But not in the case of Joseph's family. Because you're talking about decades and decades of sin and tension, because both what Jacob has done and what Jacob's sons have done. And we're not going to get too much into Jacob's toxic favoritism towards Benjamin or Joseph, because I really harped on that last week. So I'm not going to talk about that too much. And we haven't got into all of the wicked sins that the other brothers have gotten into. We will get into some more of that today. And again, that's not even everything. So there's a lot going on, guys, of what this family situation. And it really is a funny kind of catch-22. They're caught in this situation where the brothers want to do the right thing. They want to take Benjamin and bring him back down to Egypt so they can save Simeon. And they can bring back grain to save their families and their kids. They want to do the right thing. But on the other hand, they're not exactly the poster boys of trustworthiness. So Jacob, their father, has stalled the process of them taking Benjamin. And they can see their supplies of grain, again, remembering it's only 9 bags, is dwindling and dwindling and dwindling. And someone needs to step up. Someone needs to speak up to do something. We have been seeing small glimmers of hope in these brothers. Last week when we were in chapter 42, we saw that as a group, they acknowledged their guiltiness. That they shouldn't have done this to Joseph. And they actually thought about what he was feeling and what he said during those situations. Back when they didn't care, now they seem to care. And last week we saw when they discovered, the one brother discovered, he looked in his bag to feed his donkey. And there's the money he used to pay for the grain itself. And they're freaking out. They're terrified. They're literally shaking. And they're looking at each other. And they don't say, what in the world has happened? They say, what is this that God has done to us? So they're beginning to actually have the right worldview where God is being involved in their lives. It's a great thing. We're beginning to see a little bit of progress in these sons. But there needs to be more. If there is going to be redemption and reconciliation, there needs to be more than simply guilt. There needs to be more change. Will we see that change? Let's find out. Genesis 43. Genesis chapter 43. Verse 1, and the famine was sore in the land. So Moses, the narrator's like, hey guys, just so you haven't forgotten, things aren't well. Things aren't hunky-dory, all right? They've been in the famine for how many years?
7.
No, that's how long it's going to be. It's been 2 years.
I got it.
2 years in the famine, first try. Yep, 2 years in the famine. So they haven't probably seen green vegetation at all in forever. And again, they don't have a lot of food, and they have a lot of mouths to feed. Verse 2, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the corn which they brought out of Egypt, their father said unto them, go again and buy us a little food. If you think about it, how insensitive is that? Simeon's in prison. What do they expect them to do? Just waltz right down to Egypt, throw Simeon a tennis ball, tough luck, and leave back home? Like how insensitive of a father do you have to be to not think about Simeon in this case? Because he doesn't want them to take Benjamin. So there needs to be someone that steps up, shows leadership, to tell Jacob, this is the reality. This is what's really going on, and you need to let us take Benjamin. And someone actually does step up. But it's not someone you would ordinarily think. Verse 3, and Judah spake unto him, saying, and it's like, whoa, time out, Judah? The guy who originally, whose grand idea was it to sell Joseph? the guy that gets his own chapter in Scripture of all of his faults, all of his immorality, that's the guy who's going to speak up and try to be a leader and do something? Yes. That's the guy. And he says, the man did solemnly protest unto us, saying, ye shall not see my face except your brother, that's Benjamin, be with you. And if thou wilt send our brother with us, now they're looking at Jacob, if you allow us to send our brother with us, we will go down and buy thee food. But if thou wilt not send him, we will not go down. For the man said unto us, ye shall not see my face except your brother be with you. And Israel said, wherefore dealt ye so ill with me as to tell the man whether ye had yet a brother? It's like so whiny. And you see this selfishness of Jacob bleed through this text as well as the chapter before. He's just being really selfish here. You notice all the I's and my's, and you're like, wow, Jacob is so self-centered. He has made his son an idol. He has made a good thing an idol to him. And he's not willing to let it go. And they said, and notice, remember, Judah starts the conversation. And now it's they. And they said, Judah, it's been weeks, guys, since they ate all the food. It's been weeks. So it's been awkward. No one's talked to Jacob. Now finally, Judah says something. And now the others are beginning to chime in too. And we find that that's the case in reality and in normal life too as well. One person steps up and then other people feel like, oh, I have the confidence now to talk too. That happens in evangelism. Oftentimes when you're trying to share the faith with your unsaved friends and there's maybe a group of you and you have a few unsaved, a few saved, and one person brings up the Bible. One person brings up the spiritual conversation. And then all of a sudden, maybe I could talk about this too. And hopefully that's the case. And we should all strive to be the leader that shows the first initiative. So, the other brothers chime in. The man asked us straightly of our state and of our kindred, saying, is your father yet alive? Have ye another brother? And we told him, according to the tenor of these words, could we certainly know that he would say, bring your brother down? It's like, give us a break. How are we supposed to know what he was going to ask? We're not mind readers. And Judah said unto his father, and again, this is specifically Judah. And Judah said unto Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones. I will be surety for him. Of my hand shall they require him. If I bring him not unto thee, set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. The word surety means pledge. Reuben tried a pledge in the previous chapter, if you remember from verse 37 of chapter 42. And that didn't work out. So Judah says, I'll be the collateral. I'll be the security guard for Benjamin. And if I can't do it, and I can't bring him down and bring him back to you so he's right there in front of your eyes, I will take the blame forever, and that also includes his family. That's what he says. Except we had lingered, surely now we had returned this second time. Now, it's a little confusing in the King James. I looked it around in a few other versions. Basically, Judah's saying, hey, in all the time that we've been taking to not really do anything, we could have taken Benjamin and brought him back to you twice by now. Now, question. What's the difference between Reuben's pledge that I can do this and Judah's pledge saying I can do this?
Judah's like, if I can't, then you can blame him.
Okay, and how's that different from Reuben?
Because Reuben was like, I can do this, but he didn't say anything about if he couldn't.
Close. Like, the conditions are different. And how are the conditions different when you compare them? Yes?
When Reuben said, for the blame, he said that he could kill his kids.
Yeah, you can slay my sons. Like, I'll promise on the life of my kids that I'll do this. But Judah says, I will take the blame. He puts himself first. Okay, what else is different between Judah? You can look at the Reuben verse. It's the previous chapter. I feel like eating a delicious Reuben right now. I'm so hungry. But the previous verse in 42:37. What's the difference between Reuben and Judah? Is there a length difference?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Judah talks a whole lot more. Reuben's like, knee-jerk response, says a few statements, and Jacob looks at Reuben, no. Judah keeps going on and on to press the point. Judah also acknowledges the kids, the little ones, that this isn't just the 12 sons and Jacob thing. This is the whole family, the whole big family. So there are some differences here. And Jacob told Reuben no, straight up. One thing I want to stress here, in terms of culture, the ancient Middle East, compared to the United States of America in the 21st century, are completely different when we look at families. Back then, it mattered to be the eldest. It mattered where you were chronologically in the sons or daughters, how old you were. It really mattered. So Jacob looks at Reuben and says, no, disqualified. So the question should be for us, putting ourselves in the culture of the day, who's the next in line to replace as the surrogate oldest? And I have put the sons in order here. First one is Reuben, going this way. So Reuben, Simeon. Where's Simeon?
Jail.
Yeah, it's going to be a little hard for him. The great escape. Bum, 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 bum. And come and take Benjamin and come back down. So no, Simeon's not an option. What about Levi? I think there's a reason why not Levi. And that comes from Genesis 34. And you don't necessarily have to turn there. I'm going to condense the whole story of Genesis 34. Remember, we started this whole series in what chapter? 37. So this happened before we started this whole thing, right? So one thing that people don't often think about this family, about Jacob and his 12 sons, is that it wasn't just the 12 sons. Now, history remembers the 12 sons, but there actually was a daughter. Leah's last child was a girl.
What?
It's still recorded in Scripture. It's just we pass over this, okay? We don't think about this often. This is where she would be in the line. Leah's last child. In chapter 34, Leah's like, I'm going to go see the daughters of the land. So she leaves home. This is probably not a good idea. Why would you hang around pagans and wicked cities and nations that are around you without staying in a safer area? But that's besides the point of what happens. She's out there, she's in this city, and there's a guy by the name of Shechem. Now, we've seen the word Shechem before, it's a location. This is actually a guy named Shechem, and he is a prince. Okay, he's a prince of this small city. He sees Dinah. Remember, Rachel, Leah, beautiful. Okay, Abraham, the guy's handsome. She's gorgeous. He lusts after her. He takes her. He rapes her. And then he says, I want to marry her. And I want to have her. And he reminds you of Samson. I want her. He goes to his father and says, I want her. Father doesn't care. Great idea. Wonderful. One thing I want to stress. This whole time throughout this series, we've split the siblings into two groups. Those that are biologically from Rachel. And basically everyone else. So from the older brother's perspective, it's not just that Dinah's the little sister. It's the little sister, and in their mind, the youngest. Okay? Keep that in mind. So they all meet in a field. And it's Jacob. It's the brothers, the older brothers. It's this guy by the name of Shechem and his dad. Jacob does nothing. He does nothing. Scripture says he held his peace. Now, interestingly, psychologically, when you suppress something that you should do, things go bad. All right, there's consequences. Scripturally, we say it's the sin of omission. When you should do something, you don't do it. There are consequences. So where Jacob lacks in action and emotion, the sons go way overboard. Okay? They get furious. They're ticked. Okay, now they should be. Okay? Emotionally, that's good. Anger in and of itself intrinsically is just saying emotionally that something is wrong and something terrible has happened. Their sister was raped. But what they do with their anger and how they allow it to manifest itself is sin and their choice. Okay? So, Shechem's in this field and he says, I love this Dinah girl. She's great. She's wonderful. I want to marry her. I'll do whatever it takes. Whatever dowry, I'll pay it. Whatever you do, whatever demands you make, I'll do it. And the text tells us in chapter 34 that the brothers, again, it's their little sister, they thought deceitfully. And they look at Shechem and they say, fine. And Shechem's like, great, this is wonderful. We'll get married and all of our families from this little city, all of us will allow our daughters and sons to marry your daughters and sons. We'll have this huge family connection, and it'll be great, and there'll be trading privileges, and we'll just be one big happy family. And the sons are like, yeah, that's fine. You can marry Dinah. We can have all this. One condition. All of the males have to be circumcised. Shechem's like, fine, cool, great, all good. So the king of that little city and Shechem leave to go back to their city, and they actually convince all the males within that city to do that, to take the procedure to be circumcised, all right? So they do it. And on the third day, they're in pain from the procedure. It's like so awkward to talk about. Levi and Simeon take their favorite swords. They waltz up to this city. It says in the text, they boldly entered it. They go straight in the gate. And they blitz the city and they kill all of the males. They murder every single male, including Shechem and his dad, the king. Kill them all. And then the rest of the older sons come in and they plunder the city.
Where was Reuben?
He was a part of it.
And so plundered. Simon and Levi.
Levi and Simon killed every one of the males. Everyone, all the other older brothers, they plunder. This is all the other sons do it. So think about it from Abraham's perspective. They're not a huge nation. So Abraham's like, what have you done? You've killed us all. Because all the other nations are going to hear about this. They'll combine themselves and they'll just wipe us out. And the sons are like, no one's going to treat our sister that way. That is Genesis 34. Now, our response is like, how? God, how can you take such wicked men and do anything remotely good with these men? How could you allow them to be the 12 tribes of Israel? And guys, that's kind of the point. That it's not that they earned the respect and honor of being the 12 tribes, and it's not that Judah did anything to be a part of the line of Christ. It's in spite of it. In spite of who they are, God, by His grace alone, allows them to be the 12 tribes of Israel. That being said, at this stage, they're finally changing. So Judah steps up. How does Jacob respond to Judah's pledge? Go ahead, Nick.
Where did Levi go, though?
What do you mean, where did he go?
Like, you said that, like, the next in line was Judah, but, like...
Yeah, so I'm saying that Levi was viewed as disqualified himself. Because actually, both of them are the ones that killed a bunch of... So, disqualified, but still disqualified. Genesis 38, but again, it's in spite of what they've done. And God is gracious. Verse 11. And their father Israel said unto them, if it must be so, do this. Take the best fruits of the land in your vessels. Carry down the man a present. A little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, nuts, and almonds. And take double money in your hand. Okay, why double? And the money that was brought again in the mouth of your bags, carried again in your hand. Peradventure it was an oversight. Maybe it's just one big mistake. Because of all those bags, They had their money, little money bags in them. Take also your brother, and arise, go again unto the man. And this is something amazing. And God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may send away your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. So Jacob's beginning to let go of Benjamin and understand God's original promise that if God promises that I can make a nation that are as the sand of the sea, huge nation from you, that I'm going to take care of kids. So he lets Benjamin go. All right? And the narrator, Moses, he's like, okay, we don't need to know all the details of them traveling back, so he kind of speeds up. And the men took the present and took double money in their hand, and Benjamin rose up and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. Shoot! Fast forward. 16. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, and he said to the ruler of his house, bring these men home and slay and make ready, for these men shall dine with me at noon. They had passed the first test. Benjamin was alive, and they could at least be counted trustworthy and honest in that regard. It also kind of let them know that their father, Jacob, trusted them enough to not walk down with them and baby them. So to some degree, he must understand that Jacob trusted them with Benjamin, and Benjamin trusted them with Benjamin. And I love it how it sounds like Joseph had everything planned from verse 16. That, okay, I see him. Now we're going to do this, this, and this, and this. Joseph's got more tests. 17. And the man did as Joseph bade, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house, and the men were afraid. Okay, because remember, all the way back, they're thinking, we are not thieves. We are not thieves. We are not thieves. And they're afraid because of all the money they found in their bags. And the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, because of the money that was returned in our sacks at the first time, are we brought in, that they may seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for bondmen and our donkeys. All right, so they're like, okay, they're just going to invite us in, this unusual request to be at the second in command's house, and they're just going to wipe us out and take all our stuff. They are terrified, and combining that with the unusual crest of being in his house, you know, they're suspicious of everything. So much like they can't handle it. And then all of a sudden they see the steward that they originally paid for the grain. So they like rush up to him. And they came near to the steward of Joseph's house, and they communed with him at the door of the house and said, oh sir, we came indeed down the first time to buy food. And it came to pass when we came to the inn that we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the mouth of his sack, and our money was in full weight, and we had brought it again into our hands, and other money we have brought down into our hands to buy food. We cannot tell who put our money in our bags. It wasn't us. We don't know what's going on here. And this is the moment of truth. Like, you don't know if the steward's going to be furious. You don't know if he's going to be dumbfounded. You don't know if he's going to be like, ha, Joseph's got something planned for you. And not say Joseph. But you know what I mean. Like, this could be the moment of, yeah, you're off to get killed or whatever. And he said, this is the steward, peace be unto you, fear not. Your God and the God of your father hath given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. I got it. And when I think of their facial expression, I think of terror mixed with a smile. It's like, what? Like, really? Like, we're good? Everything's okay?
Can you please do that?
No, I will not. There's so many moments in Storks, the movie, that they have that facial expression. Anyways. Rabbit trail. Notice the steward says, the God of your father. Okay? He says, the God of your father. I think because Joseph is so meticulous in doing all these tests, this is my speculation, that he is even told what the steward should say, that they bring up God, because he wants them thinking they have all these mysterious things that go on to test them to see if they have really changed. 24. And the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water and washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys provender, and they made ready the present against Joseph. I think this is funny. I mean, he's second in command of all Egypt. What's this little present going to do like he has anything his heart could wish. And they brought him the present, which is in their hand, into the house, and bowed themselves to the earth, and he asked of them of their welfare, doesn't mention anything about his response to the gift, and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom ye spake? Is he yet alive?" And they answered, "Thy servant our father is in good health, he is yet alive." And they bowed their heads and made obeisance to him, and he lifted up his eyes, and he saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. Guys, this is the only brother that he has that hasn't done him anything wrong. This is the only brother that he has whose love and loyalty he does not have to question. And this is also the only one that also came from Rachel. It says, "And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother, and he sought where to weep, and he entered into his chamber, and he wept there." And that lets us know, guys, that this is not simply a game. All right, you know, you read the other chapters, and you're like, oh, it's kind of funny, because Joseph's bilingual, and he knows what's going on. They have no idea that he can speak Hebrew as well as Egyptian. And he's doing all these tests, and it's like a contest. It's some reality show. It's not a game for Joseph. He wants to tell them who he is. But he's not until he sees change in their hearts. And he washed his face and went out and refrained himself and said, "Set on bread." And they set on for him by himself and for themselves, by themselves, and for the Egyptians, which to eat with him by themselves. Clarification. Because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, and the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled at one another. And what are the odds that he put everyone in order? I mean, everyone knows from the conversations that they've had, they know that Benjamin is the youngest. Okay? That this second in command would certainly know that, but you know, these are all older guys. It's hard to tell people's age when they get older. It's easier when they're younger. I am terrible at guessing ages of people. But that put a question in my mind, okay? So what are the odds? What are the odds that Joseph would put 10 men at a table together in order? So I asked our math teacher here at Calvary, who's just a brain, and she got on the phone with her sister, who's an engineer, who's also a brain, and they had this little conversation, and they were going over the formulas, and they were going over, well, if it was a round table or a square table, and all this stuff, and I was like, okay, whatever. It was like pig Latin just flying at me, and I was like, okay, sure. And they did all the math, and the odds of how many different possible combinations Joseph could have put the brothers in is 3,628,800. Different question. What is the percentage probability of simply picking the right order randomly? What are the chances? 5%? 1%?
0.001%.
0.001%. No? Okay. 0.0000002% of choosing the correct order. No kidding that they marveled, alright? Yeah, I'm sure they didn't have Texas calculators and they were all working it out themselves. I don't think, you know, that happened. But they understood that this is weird, alright? This is another mystery of what in the world is going on. And they took and sent messes, it just means portions, okay, portions of food, unto them from before them. But Benjamin's portion was 5 times so much as any of the others, and they drank and were merry with him. Okay, so that's another opportunity for them, for Joseph to see if they're going to be envious of Benjamin getting all these extra portions of food. That is chapter 43. So just a few takeaways, just to think about. What does this chapter teach us about God? That God's grace is so powerful that it can overcome, that it can like flip upside down man's incredible wickedness. You hear things on the news, I see stuff all the time, and I'm like, that is so bad. Why would a person choose to do that? You hear about stories, and you're like, it's so evil. what's going on in our world today. God is so powerful, he can even turn the evil and the malevolence of our world and make it into good. He is that sovereign and that powerful. And we see it really strongly in this Joseph story. What does that tell you? Looking at the lives of Simeon and Levi, Reuben, Judah, what do their experiences teach us about how we view people that we think have gone off the deep end? Is it impossible for them to turn back? Is it impossible for them, for God to work redemptively in their hearts and for them to actually change? It's not impossible. When we make big mistakes and we look at ourselves and we see the reality of our sin and we're like, I've chosen this, I feel terrible, I feel like trash, I obviously am trash, I can't do this Christian life, obviously God can never use me, I might as well just keep on sinning. False. We can still be redeemed. God can still use someone in some way. I think it's kind of eye-opening to even ask the question, is God working tests in your life to see if you are growing, to see if you are responding well, just like Joseph's testing his brothers? It's God too. Is God testing you in your life? And it's good to look at what's going on in your life and to ask that question. Teaches us, especially with the father's relationship with the sons, you know, they have a history and they're trying to do the right thing, that this whole reconciliation process, guys, takes time. And it rarely does it just speed up miraculously and just everything sticks, okay? Rarely happens. And even though the process of reconciliation has started, that it's slow. It is slow, and you have to take that into account. You try to help people, and then mess up again and again and again, and try to help people, and you pour your life into someone, trying to steer them on a better path, and then they make another mistake, and you just put up your hands and say, I give up. No, you keep trying. This guy can work. That's all I have. Thank you again for listening so much. You guys were great. That's all I have.